Hello and welcome. I am Piers Ridyard, CEO of the decentralized finance protocol Radix, a public ledger entirely focused on bringing DeFi to the mainstream. This is our podcast, The DeFi Download, a show about decentralized finance and all things crypto, where we dive into the details of the projects, assets, and services that are powering the DeFi revolution. I just wanted to record a little intro at the start of this one, particularly because this was actually the first podcast we recorded, and I do apologize, the sound quality is much worse than the future ones will have, but I did enjoy the conversation with Tom Tobridge so much that I wanted to make sure that we put it out in this episode. So without further ado, over to the podcast. Well, thank you very much for joining for the podcast. I really appreciate that. I think that it would be really good if you could just at the top of the podcast, if you could just introduce yourself, sort of a bit about what you've done, and sort of why you're on talking about governance.
I'm sure. Well, Piers, thank you for having me. You know, my name is Tom Trowbridge, and I was one of the founders of Hedera Hashgraph. And, you know, when I joined Manson Lehman, the company was Swirls, and they knew they wanted a governing council. And that was kind of an important concept that, given the proof of stake model they had, but it hadn't been fleshed out too much beyond that. And so we really put our heads together and worked to come up with what we thought was, you know, over many months, what we thought was a very workable governance solution. And, you know, I guess, why do I care? Why am I interested in governance? And I think, you know, partly being involved in a lot of businesses before has given me some experience in terms of, you know, how people act and kind of how to game theory out different scenarios. Also, I think it probably doesn't hurt that both my parents and one of my sisters are attorneys. And so, you know, their perspective is always looking at what can go wrong. And that's obviously the reverse of most entrepreneurs who are always focused on what can go right. And, right. You know, I certainly have the blue sky side of entrepreneurialism, but I have been, you know, indoctrinated in some of the what can go wrong concept. And I think with governance, to come up with good governance, you always have to be thinking about what could go wrong, because things often do.
And was that like the biggest part of forming the Hedera Governing Council was looking to, well, how do we mediate conflict? How do we resolve issues? Was that the sort of the main motivation for it?
Well, it was less about that, more, although that came up, it was more about how do you prevent bad actors from influencing it? How do you prevent concentration? And how do you create a governance mechanism that structurally is very difficult to compromise or take advantage of? And so if you start with how do we prevent it from being corrupted or taken advantage of, then you have to think about, okay, how do you corrupt or take advantage of systems? Mm-hmm. And you've got to think about all the different ways someone could try to do that. And you think, okay, who would want to take advantage of it? What would their motivations, resources be? And you go down that road. So it was more about the protection of the purity or of at least the governance model than it was a how do we mediate between different parties.
Okay. I mean, like a lot of the early decentralized ledger sort of community, especially around Bitcoin and Ethereum, sort of the code is law, would sort of posit that you don't really need any of that beyond just a adversarial approach to how you create the code within a you know, a Byzantine fault tolerance system. And why do you need anything beyond just the rules of the code? So I suppose that leads to the question, like, why do you think governance beyond just what the code says you can do is so important for decentralized systems?
Well, listen, it's a foundational question. I think something that's glossed over by many people. And, you know, first, there's two different types of things we're talking about here. So first, let's just make it super clear. Consensus happens by code, whether that's the Bitcoin, whether it's, you know, Radix, you know, Ethereum, Hedera, whatever. So we're talking about governance, which is how the system architecture evolves, who steers that evolution, and how does it get implemented. And so while the actual mechanisms of, you know, smart contract enforcement, whatever that is, can be done specifically code as law, when it comes time to do a code update, who's determining that code update? How is it implemented? Who accepts it? How many have to accept it? And, you know, you think about the laws of power and, you know, the first law, the sort of the most basic piece or the sort of last bits, who votes on it? But before you get that, it's like, who decides what's on the agenda to even vote on? Mm. And so when we're talking about governance, we're talking about who's guiding the whole protocol forward. And so Bitcoin is obviously, you know, progressed at a very, you know, measured and appropriate pace. You know, its governance consists of two different constituencies, the core developer teams that basically pull in and prioritize code updates, and then that has to be accepted by the miners. And, you know, Ethereum has somewhat similar concept. And, you know, those for Bitcoin in particular, that's worked very well. It's kept Bitcoin functioning. It's gone through some updates. Now, I question, you know, whether that is appropriate for a protocol that has ambitions for thousands or millions of enterprises being on it that would seem to need to develop at a faster pace and include more enhancements than Bitcoin, where its constituency is a very different one than Bitcoin. But I guess I would say that the code is law concept actually applies to almost no protocols. The only ones you could talk about that would maybe be on-chain voting protocols, where if you have a coin or a token, you can vote, and whatever you vote wins, and that's that. And that's sort of a, you know, an EOS model for one example. And that is rife with all kinds of problems, which when you basically have economics dictate the governance going forward, as you can easily, you know, understand.
Mm. I mean, like, that's often the incentive that is built into the systems in the first place, right? Is like this sort of founding principle of, I just want people to work in a rational, economic, and selfish way for an emergent property of the system to come about. It's sort of like this idea of how Bitcoin is able to function. But I think that there's that if you just create people working in just economically rational ways, and you have no other concept of the benefits that the system can accrue to people who maybe aren't miners, for example, or aren't running the network, but are actually stakeholders in it and rely on it, you definitely start to see where that's going to start to fall down if you only have the people who are running the network only working in a short-sighted, sort of selfish manner, right?
Right. Well, and Pierce, I'll go... you know, another level on this, which is, I think we also have to think forward and use our imagination as to where we think this industry is going to be in, pick your date, 5 years, 10 years. And if we achieve the scalability, obviously, that the Radix clearly intends to, and that Hedera, you know, has implemented to some extent now, and others are working hard to do, you know, we expect a great deal of commerce to be running on any of these platforms. And the more commerce you have running on them, the more incentive there is for parties to try to take advantage of it, and for parties to try to corrupt it, or for one protocol, frankly, interest to try to nefariously hurt another protocol. And so the problem with the rational actor economic argument is that in sort of closed laboratory settings, that makes a ton of sense. But when you get to the level where you could have, you know, pick an example, say you have a US dollar stable coin, or, you know, pick it, the renminbi running on the ledger. Like, I think they'll probably be kept private for this reason. But if you had a systematically important currency running on, pick your network, now all of a sudden you could have a state actor interested in disrupting that ledger. And so when you start to think about the powers of either very large companies that may have an interest adverse to some of these technologies succeeding, or even states that are threatened by them, now you enter into areas where the economic interest is so much bigger than the current system. And then the system could be in a couple of years. You have to think larger than just everyone's going to maximize their return in that system. because the returns of many of these parties could accrue if that system in fact failed, right? And so that becomes a much more complicated task to model and to protect against.
Right. And I also think you're often dealing with, like, it's nice to believe that you can always have everyone in alignment at all times, but often you're dealing with conflicting desires where, you know, the benefit to one party may actually mean the service being more expensive to another, or may mean that running one thing is highly beneficial for one company, but actually makes another company's use of that service more difficult. Yep. And so you have to have this way of balancing the digital commons or the common good that is the platform. And I always end up going between viewing this as either as a digital commons, which has all of the problems that you often have with the tragedy of the commons and just everyone being selfish about the management of it. Look at, you know, the way that fishing stocks are managed, or look at the way that grazing fields used to be managed. And often what happened as a result, if people were able to act in purely selfish and were not able to coordinate together to come to a better outcome. But also sometimes looking at just what happens with states and state breakdown and how good governance and bad governance looks at a state level. Because often when writ large, these systems do start to look more and more like digital countries.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think that is a real concern. And I think that the distinction between, to try to draw that analogy even larger, sort of the tragedy of the commons concept, is that not only could your rational interest, you know, maybe hurt others, but you might have someone who has a field next door and they want the commons to be a muddy, you know, desolate lot, so their field becomes more valuable, right? So they just put all their animals on it because they want to be muddy so they can sell theirs for more, right? Like you can keep this analogy going even more in this landscape, because again, it's not a closed system.
Right. How much were you guys concerned when you were building the Hedera governance model about other projects coming and being adversarial in sort of a dirty tricks kind of way?
That we weren't concerned about it from our standpoint. I think our model is really set up to be pretty resistant to that. I think that model, the projects that are more vulnerable to that model are some of the on-chain voting mechanisms or the reputational mechanisms. Mm. Mechanisms that are more, I think, kind of traditional, I think, or maybe traditional is the wrong word, but more on-chain related, I think are more vulnerable to those. We weren't as worried about that from our side. We were sort of, from day one, thought that the enterprise component would protect against that. It introduces other issues, obviously, but it wasn't. It does leave it pretty resistant to other protocol, kind of behavior, I guess, in a way that it doesn't. If you want to, you're a big protocol and you want to challenge, you know, a coin weighted voting one, you know, there are ways. There's. It's a far easier to do that.
Mm. So let's dive into a couple more specific examples. What projects do you think are currently getting these systems right? Like what are you seeing that's happened or is happening at the moment in the industry that you're like, yes, that's a really good way of doing things. I really like that, or I really like that project for these reasons.
I'm obviously biased, and I think Hedera set up something interesting. I know that is, it's not widely understood. I'll just mention it for a moment so people can know it, and then we can, and then go from there. But you know what?
Sure.
And just so people know, I wrote a piece on Medium, Tom Trofor at Medium, if you want to see it, that talks about kind of governance in the whole space. But Hedera's concept is that you've got this council of enterprises that first are not economically motivated. They don't have, they're not getting dividends. And secondly, they're term limited to only 3 years. And the third concept is that they then vote to find their replacements. And so that leads, we think, to diversification in geography, time, and also industry, which we think helps provide a persistently decentralized, you know, community effectively of people that are actually going to be using the technology. And I you know, too early to tell, right? We don't know, the console still being built. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, it's sort of the Chinese proverb when they ask, you know, how's the, what do you think of the French Revolution? How'd that work out? And they're like, well, you know, it's too early to tell 200 years later. So, you know, we need a time to see if this works. I think, you know, it's easier for me to lob criticisms around. I guess, you know, you obviously, the default in the community, I think, is the Bitcoin model. And I think that is really has proven itself to work. The challenge is, how replicable is it? You need to have buy-in from core developers, and you need to have, you know, miners that you can't really, that won't really settle or adopt things that developments that don't, that hurt their economics. And so while that works really well, I think for Bitcoin, you know, I think that you were seeing problems when you have something like that with regard to like an Ethereum update, where the proof of stake is going to be detrimental potentially to the rewards of the miners, and that creates real difficulty in moving the system forward. And so you either need to set up something where you don't have ambitions to change it. The scale is what the scale is. You expect to have relatively modest technology improvements, and that's fine. That, I think, has worked incredibly well for Bitcoin. I think that that is a, you got to be careful when implementing a system like that going forward. You know, I'll tell you that within a closed loop system, Polkadot has interesting concepts where voting, you know, you get more votes the longer you lock up your dots. At least that was the last version of it that I read. Mm-hmm. And I think that is interesting. So your vote counts as sort of a multiplier of how long you want to lock it up. And sure. I think that that's
a bit like Decred. Decred has a similar idea as well.
And those rationally, like, that makes sense. That means you're going to have a longer deal. You'll be more attached to this network. And so you're going to have a longer horizon. So your vote should count more. Again, that to me, I like. Does that prevent someone, again, from outside the system voting something in against the interest system because their reward is far larger in another place? No, not at all. But that's an example of something that in the closed system makes a ton of sense. In a grander system, you know, I'm not sure how much it helps.
Yeah, I suppose like there's the Hedera model is an interesting sort of approach in that it's sort of it's very inorganic in its growth. You have to you sort of have to go out and find the stakeholders for whom you think the system is going to be most important for, and convince them to be part of the system. Yep. and then hope that that system then builds its own momentum. Whereas something like the Ethereum model or the Bitcoin model is much sort of more organic in its scope. It's like you don't have to be part of anything to get in here.
You're right.
But there is going to be a little more anarchy in how things sort of like turn out. And I think that's often, you know, if you look at the problems that happened with the Bitcoin block size and the sort of the subsequent forks that occurred, there's really good arguments on both sides. One being like, well, that was governance working because the governance should resist changes into the underlying protocol of an immutable ledger, and it should require a very large movement of community for you really to move anything to do with the code. And it's interesting, like, I've heard things similar said from government officials themselves. Like a minister told me that one of the main functions of the mechanism of government is making it very difficult to change laws quickly. And I think that some of that sort of like brutal simplicity in how Bitcoin governance happens can be seen as what result is. And some people at the time were like, oh, that's a failure in governance. And then you look at it over time, you're like, well, maybe it's not. Maybe that's what the point of the Bitcoin code is. And then, but then you also look at things like what created Ethereum Classic, right? When the DAO hack happened. And while that may have been the right decision, you know, to reverse the hack and make sure that people got their funds back. There wasn't a forum for doing it. There wasn't any place in which a discussion could occur. And that ended up meaning that that anarchy actually created, even though the decision was okay, there wasn't a good forum for it. You weren't really sure who was party to the decision, how the decision was made, and it was subsequently announced and pushed by the foundation. Fine, but I think that it would have been much more helpful if there was like a more formal organization to be able to at least discuss and air all sides of the disagreements that might happen so that a decision could be reached in a more orderly fashion.
Well, listen, I agree. There are a lot of things to respond to on that. And, you know, I think on the government side of it, if you think you're obviously all prisoners of our experiences and, you know, you're UK, I'm US. And I think that the American system, to your point, was specifically designed to have government not be very active. Like, you know, people talk about how hard it is to get things done. And they forget that's the point of why you have houses that are voted by different ways with different powers, Supreme Court. Like, the whole point was to make things complicated. If our founders had wanted government to work really quickly, there's a lot of ways to make it work a lot faster than how they designed it. And so this was specifically architected to make it really, really sort of a broad consensus necessary for any material changes to happen. And so that's the whole point. So I 100% agree with you there. And then, and I think that does tie nicely to the Bitcoin concept with again, the exception or the comment that Bitcoin is only supposed to do a certain thing. And so that's fine. I don't know how well that mechanism works if you're trying to build something that you're still in the process of building it and you want it to be able to scale and evolve and change to meet the needs of the globe. And that's a different, I think that might require more speedy response times and speedy adjustments than is allowed for in the Bitcoin governance model. With regard to Ethereum, the thing that I don't like is if you have the Bitcoin model, great. If you have a different model, fine. But the decentralized models that are actually centralized but masked as decentralized, I have a big problem with those. And so your point on the DAO, you know, quote, put the hack in quotes here, is that was really, from everything I've understood, decided by the Ethereum Foundation, very minimal input from the community, small number of votes, very, to your point, opaquely decided. So don't call yourself a decentralized protocol with decentralized governance when a couple people can decide it. And that, you know, there's a huge part of the community that basically views Ethereum as a centralized governance model as a result of that. And not without, you know, good reason.
Yeah, it's I think this is sort of like runs into sort of my next question, which is like, can a good governance system be retrofitted to a successful network?
I mean, listen, I think the answer is yes. The problem is what is the existing system? Because that system needs to approve the retrofitting. And so... Yeah. That what it really dramatically differs on what that system is and how and what those interests of those people are, or those actors are, versus the new one. And we're seeing the problems in Ethereum with that right now. Are there other systems that have successfully undergone a change in governance? I mean, what you're effectively saying is you want to shift power from one group to another. That's not an easy thing to do.
Right. I think that's sort of very visible with things like what's happening with EOS. And the EOS example is a particularly interesting one because EOS started with a set of rules, I'm forgetting the word. What's the American Constitution? It started with the Constitution. that sort of laid out the rules and was actually, you know, very carefully put together, and then was just sort of just ripped up. And then this sort of like this sort of much simpler model came about. And now we have all of these issues that we're seeing where sort of the people, the largest Ethereum holders, are voting entirely in their own self-interest. And it's interesting because we had a chat with Thomas Cox, who is the guy who designed the governance mechanisms for EOS that weren't rolled out. He very strongly believes that that once a system is in flight, it's very difficult to go and change it. I'm still on the fence on this. Do you think that Ethereum could adopt a better governance system, and what would be the first thing that you would do to start that process?
Listen, I don't know where to start. I guess you'd have to figure out what you were trying to achieve. And, you know, the issue is that Vitalik is by far the most powerful advocate for that network and for the protocol. And he obviously exercises a material influence in the direction of the project. And so if you were to change governance such that Ethereum Foundation and he was less involved, that'd have to be a formal process because, you know, informally, of course, he's going to exercise control. And then the second question, do you want to? You know, you argue that, what does he want? He wants it to be adopted and be successful. And you could argue the same thing about, a variety of other kind of benevolent dictators that I would argue he's probably not corruptible. He probably has the best interest of the network at heart. It's his legacy. So yeah. I think that having someone like that involved, I don't think is bad. The question is, what happens next? And what happens, you know, after Vitalik? And who does it transition to? Who takes that power? Does the foundation take that power? Does it get dissipated? People in the community step up? Maybe, and that could happen. We just don't know. How you take it away from the miners is the real problem. And, you know, one of the things that I like on Hedera's side, and this is sort of, I think, lacking in others, is that Hedera wants corporations really to be using it. We think Hedera thinks those are the real users in high volume of this. And they're governing. And so that, to me, is very linked up. And so if you're building a protocol, pick your EOS, for example, you know, right now, who are the EOS block producers? You know, they're not, by and large, they're miners, right? And they're exchanges or their exchanges vote for them, et cetera. Economically motivated, great. But that's still a little bit different than having the actual users of the network being the ones that have a say in the governance of it. And I think if you really want to be widely adopted, to your point, thinking about all the different trade-offs you have to make, and, you know, don't you want users involved in those discussions and decisions?
Do you see that eventually extending all the way down to the individual? Or do you think that will always stop at the companies and the developers and the entrepreneurs who decide to use XYZ platform over another platform?
You know, it could. I bet you could see multiple successful outcomes. You could see governance that was heavily driven by the community. That to me is certainly an interesting way. The way that works now is really developers that do that. And I think, you know, there's some projects I'm familiar with where it's basically a protocol for developers. And so developers are the ones that are going to be, it's sort of unique in that regard, and developers are real ones using it. And so they're going to be the ones heavily involved in governance. And so I think that ties in well. If you're talking about, you know, every holder of Bitcoin having a say in how Bitcoin develops and manages and goes forward, that to me is a bit cumbersome. I'm not sure the easy way to do that. I don't even know what kind of turnout you'd get for that. So that strikes me as maybe a bridge too far, but I'll bet you there's some other sort of, you know, interim possibilities.
Yeah, it's sort of really interesting. Like when I first got into Ethereum, the concept of like liquid democracy and direct participation and all that kind of stuff was very much the main talk. Like, governance seems to almost have been forgotten in that it is such an important aspect, but like it feels like as soon as things start to be successful and move and people are, it's less of a talking shop about what the future might look like and actually just sort of going ahead and building stuff, that sometimes you're like, well, actually, these governance systems, if we don't think about them now and there is a problem later on down the line, it becomes very difficult to actually give people a way of, yeah, like working it out. Now, obviously, one of the ways of working it out with these decentralized systems, apart from in the case of Hedera, which is why I wanted to sort of talk about forking specifically, is, you know, this ability to fork, this ability of a community to say, hey, I disagree with where this is going. And because it's open source and because we can choose to split. We can say we're going to create our own new digital state over here and you guys can carry on in this state over here, but we're going to leave. So like, could you talk a little bit about how you think governance and forking sort of like overlap and some of the sort of like difficult decisions you have to make on both sides of the fence then?
Yeah, listen, forking, you know, there are no investor in particular who likes open source projects. Always present is what he feels is an optimal decision-making process, because should whoever is making decisions do something drastically wrong, the community always has the option to fork it. And so he thinks that is a good sort of, I wouldn't quite say gun to the head, but a credible threat to enforce appropriate decision-making. And I think that there's a real point to that. The problem is we've seen many cases with the DAO, one just being one, where forks happen. And what you can't argue is that, you know, I'm sorry, I'm a fan of the double negative, is that they aren't destructive. And so forks clearly do not help either the industry or certainly that company or protocol, and does not inspire more people to use it. You know, I think that the ideal is you avoid forks. The more complex the protocols get, the more companies and applications depend on the state, and the more ramifications there will be for a fork and for, you know, competing states to exist. And so I do think you want that, obviously always exists for open source. And I think that is certainly a appropriate, alternative and does provide some good incentives, but is it sufficient? You know, I don't think so. And there's nothing to say that when the fork happens, what then are the governance mechanisms of that fork? Is that a new governance model or not? Has that set up, and you end up with the same problem all over again? Not sure.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. Like, because like again, like my mind has shifted on this over the course of the years. Like early days, I used to think, oh, you know, like forking Bitcoin, detracts from the value of Bitcoin. And I remember when Ethereum Classic happened and like the way that split the community and how upsetting that was. Sort of, because I mean, I invested in the DAO and like I was part and parcel in like sort of being very, like I was very excited about what Ethereum was capable of with all of these things, so it's governance and investment. And it was very early in that genesis of what became the Ethereum community. And it really did wrench the community apart. But I actually think that it was incredibly important, because what it allowed is, it didn't just allow dissatisfaction. It didn't allow people to just sit there and stew and go, well, if we'd been allowed to go this direction, then everything would be better. Because you're allowed to have that scenario play out, and it gives you multiple ways in which it could. So, like, I can see how not, like, preventing forking can feel like a good way of keeping something monolithic. But I don't think these things are monolithic. I think they are community-led. I think they are down entirely to what the community wants. And sometimes communities do split, and that is your hard power, this ability to fork. But I think that because Ethereum Classic happened, and then because nothing really happened with Ethereum, I'm going to get a load of Ethereum Classic fanboys coming after me for this, but like, because nothing really happened with Ethereum Classic, it was a way of showing that Ethereum was stronger and was a better way, but it meant that any of the unhappy community members weren't just sitting around going, well, you know, the DAO hack happened and you gave the money back and you've broken the promise of Ethereum and therefore you've destroyed the value of Ethereum. If you believed that, you could go for Ethereum. You had the alternative. You had that exit point. And I think with Bitcoin, like, has in the short term, we maybe thought, oh yeah, all of this forking of Bitcoin is going to make Bitcoin confusing. And you got Bitcoin Satoshi Vision, you got Bitcoin Cash, you got Bitcoin Gold, you got Bitcoin Diamond. Like, isn't this dilutive to the value of Bitcoin? I love this phrase someone said to me recently, which is the universe is infinite and zero sum thinking is finite. And like, the fact that the Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash exist doesn't necessarily mean that it's zero sum. Like, Bitcoin Cash wins, Bitcoin loses. Like, there's this organic nature of communities trying things out of value that then either succeed or fail as successes. And like, if Ethereum Classic had succeeded over Ethereum, then we'd be building on Ethereum Classic. But was like, what was more important, the idea and the code that supported the community, or keeping a community monolithic in the first place?
You know, relevant question. I mean, last time I looked at it, Bitcoin had something, you know, 44, 47 forks, something along those lines. There's Bitcoin pizza. So, you know, I think that and by the way, there could be another 100. I don't, to your point, that's not going to impact Bitcoin's adoption or price or anything going forward. So I completely agree with you there. But I do think Bitcoin's a bit of a special animal. What I was thinking about more was, and again, I'm a bit trapped in this mentality, but a bit more about what I was more referring to was sort of enterprise usage. Sure. And sure, just the concern of, gee, we just spent 2 months working with this company, and now all of a sudden there's two different groups, each claiming to be that company or each claiming to be that protocol. What do we do? And so, again, when this happened with Ethereum, they were not even talking to institutions at that time, right? So it wasn't an issue. I also think it would have been more interesting if a bigger chunk of the core team had gone to Classic and really created a competing, weight, I guess I would say. But, you know, to your point, there is room for all of this without a doubt. And I don't dispute that. And I sort of even mentioned this yesterday, you know, Hedera has, is committed to releasing its code, you know, in December, said early this year. I hope it does soon. The more I think about it, the more I think they'd benefit from code release. And the more, to your point, I don't think someone forking Hedera and trying to create an open source version of it, I think that solves for a different sort of use and governance model and everything that Hedera is doing. And so I don't think it would actually negatively impact Hedera if that were to happen. And so my thinking kind of has evolved from protect against forks at all costs to being like, you know, in many cases, they're probably okay. That's different though from an existing state being forked off and two different groups kind of competing for the same mantle, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's sort of really good arguments on all sides. Starting point is, everyone argues about everything, right? And you're always going to have splits. Like, if Hedera keeps going down the route it's going with regards to building the council, there is going to come a point where they're going to come across companies which will go, we're not going to join because those guys are in there, and so we don't want to be part of it. Because, you know, like the best example would be Ant Financial and Tencent, right? Like, Ant will not be in anything that Tencent's in, and Tencent will not be in anything that's Ant's in. They are such sworn rivals that, like, they are, like, stealing deals from each other and, like, properly getting involved with industrial espionage and all this kind of stuff. And so that kind of rivalry always is going to create scenarios where there does have to be competing systems. And I think that there will be competing systems for a long time. Like, I think, you know, Radix and Hedera and Algorand and Ethereum and EOS and all of these systems, like, are unlike companies in many ways because they are perpetual. Once the system's running, everyone can run them, and it doesn't sort of really matter what happened to the company. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens to chains over the long run versus what generally happens to companies, that they die when they run out of money. And that's just not going to happen with chains that have reached a certain degree of adoption. But I think that this sort of, like, creative destruction and trying different paths is absolutely critical to actually coming to any kind of system that we will eventually all use. Like, it's a cliche example, but, like, the internet is another example of that. The internet started off as being closed competing gardens. You had, like, AOL Online. You had the French internet, which was run by the French government. You had competing protocols, right? TCP/IP wasn't the only protocol that people were looking at using. And there was all of these experimentations that happened, and then eventually we got to the point where we were like, okay, well, this is the standard. But it was only really by it being a fully open, free to use standard that it ended up being the standard, because there wasn't any form of permission for people going, I'm going to run an experiment on this. My conclusion on this is basically, I think that in the short run, what looks like chaos actually in the long run turns out to be the ground on which the sort of the largest trees that we will rely on in the future is fertilized in.
I certainly hope so. You know, I'll just make another interesting comment. So for anyone interested in, you know, Weaving the Web is a book by Tim Berners-Lee about how he created it, which is a fascinating read. It sounds like, I'm sure it sounds like you've read it as well. I think people forget also that he created a consortium of companies to not govern, but to basically help come to consensus about standards going forward.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, he basically got the companies who would profit, who had the most invested, their hardware manufacturers primarily, together, and they paid to come together and continually adopt and evolve standards. And I think that was a good thing to do. But it worked out also because these were the companies that were going to benefit most from the web's growth. So it was sort of a narrower band than I think we're talking about here with distributed ledgers. But that's just a note that I don't think is as kind of appreciated given our views of the decentralization and democratization of it. And those are certainly Tim's ideals. But he also recognized the relevance of pulling in stakeholders and getting them to agree on at least standards, even if they weren't enforceable, but suggestions going forward. And I think that is a terrific principle that is not widely kind of discussed.
That's really interesting. Like, and in some ways you can think of, like, what is happening with smart contracts, and indeed what, you know, the Radix is doing with the Radix engine. Like, a lot of these are just about standardization of function, right? Like, if you standardize the way you issue tokens, aka ERC20, then all of the infrastructure works with it. And I think that like need for standards and that need for paying attention more to what everyone needs to work with, not just like a niche part of the industry, is going to be like critical for the success of whatever protocol is the ultimate winner at the end of this. I think that's a really important part. It's one of the more boring parts of it, right? Like, well, set a standard for how we're going to do securities, but yeah, like, really important.
Yeah, definitely right. You know, the one other thing I just want to mention just quickly, also, when we talked about participation in governance, is that I think a lot of us are so close to this industry and everyone's so passionate about it, they can't help but think everyone is going to be as passionate and care as much as they do. And there's a very obvious experiment that's been going on for a very long time is in public companies and in general elections. And so you get public company boards that have to be elected every year. Participation there is not high. And this is very easily done. It doesn't require any computer knowledge whatsoever, right?
Right.
And participation rate is incredibly low for public company governance and ends up being dominated by the shareholder services, ISS,
Elliott or whatever Capital.
Right. So I think it's also a little bit, this is sort of diverging from our topic or conversation flow a little bit, but to think that in this world, everyone is going to be voting on chain for all the different protocols that they hold or care about, to me, it sort of flies in the face of the obvious examples all around us that have been happening for a century.
I mean, that actually leads me on to my sort of one of my closing questions is future gazing. What crisis of governance do you think is waiting to happen, or a prediction of the future around that?
I guess I'd say that I don't know if we'll find the crisis will come as we as an industry become more successful and more widely adopted. And so I think that even if there were to be a crisis now, it couldn't be that big a crisis given where we are. But it's going to sneak up on us the way, you know, for example, the way that the Ethereum gas price spike completely snuck up on the Maker DeFi ecosystem. You know, the fact that Ethereum could spike 7,000% and that led to $4 million being lost in collateral, no one was going to predict that could happen. You know, if there had been $100 on the system, no one would even know about it. If there had been $100 million, there'd be, you know, riots. So, you know, I think that the success of all of us is what is going to test these systems. And we have a little ways to go before that happens. So I think we've got a year or a couple of years before there is a real crisis. I can't imagine what it is, but I expect it'll happen. And I think, frankly, someone important will probably, unfortunately, pass away at some point, and that's going to lead to some turmoil. But that could be, you know, hopefully a very long ways away.
So you stepped down as the president of Hedera. So what have you been doing during quarantine, and what are you doing next?
Well, I'm doing a couple things. So I've been advising a project quietly since October that we hope to be able to announce within the coming weeks. That's, I think, very exciting. And it's I'll just call it an open software as a service model that combines a hardware and services layer that I think is potentially, you know, really interesting. And I'm super excited about it and about the team. So that is something that I've been spending a lot of time on. And I've also, you know, I also learned a tremendous amount at Hedera, and I've put together a couple pieces that I've posted on Medium that go into everything from governance, which we've talked about now, to regulatory side and, you know, central bank digital currencies, et cetera. So anyone that cares, there are some pieces out there that I sort of wanted to at least share that information while it was in my head. And there have been some other projects, but those are the ones that have been kind of most exciting.
Awesome. So if people want to...
That and growing my beard.
That and growing your beard, which is looking fantastic. When are you going to cut it?
You know, I've told my wife that I have to, you know, have to leave the country to cut the beard. So I think that sets incentives for both of us to break quarantine. I'm not sure when that's going to happen, but you know, every week it seems a week further away. So we'll see.
Oh, dearie me. I mean, it's going to be fabulous. It's already looking marvelously bushy. So I wish you and your wife the best of luck with that. Lastly, if people want to sort of follow you and see your thoughts and just read what you're thinking, they can find you on Medium, right? How would they find you on Medium?
Yeah, well, Medium and Twitter, I'm just at TOMTROW4, the number 4. So Tom Trow, number 4. and that's, you can also find me on LinkedIn, but those are the, where probably most of my stuff is. I'm not a frequent, poster on Twitter, but, you know, I do put on there from time to time.
Awesome. Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on and giving us your time.